Fortnight in Film is a podcast where every week you get the chance to listen in on a group of film lovers chatting about the great, or not so great, movies that we've been watching over the past fortnight. Hello and welcome to episode 12 of A Fortnight in Film. I'm your host Jason.
And I'm your co-host Christian.
Thanks for tuning in. I think this episode is the first time or podcast that we've discussed a film that's actually been released this year.
As far as I know, that's correct, actually.
Because we don't review a lot of new films that come out. I mean, I don't know about you. I don't watch a lot of new films either. I'm catching up on the hundreds, the 100+ years of cinema that I haven't watched.
Yeah, I used to, but. Yeah, with COVID, I have gone to the theaters, like, once we got vaccinated and we, you know, felt better about it. We've seen a couple movies. I think we just saw Antlers, I think it was called, which was a huge disappointment for me. And a huge disappointment for my friend, who's, like, a really big horror movie fan. And he went with us, and he was sitting next to me. And we were watching it, and I could kind of hear him, like, be disappointed. Like, I can hear the disappointment in his breathing because he was really looking forward to it. He read the short story it's based off and everything. And then I saw Green Knight, which I really, really enjoyed. But I do understand why it has some detractors. I think those are the only movies I've really gone and seen in theaters in past year at least. What about you?
I haven't seen a lot. I've seen, so in the cinema, I've seen Those Who Wish Me Dead with Angelina Jolie, which was average. I saw Wrath of Man with Jason Statham, which was, again, sort of average. I saw The Last Duel. I thought that was good.
Ooh, I really wanted to see that one.
I probably didn't like it as much as everyone on Letterboxd seems to like it, but I thought it was a good film. And then on Wednesday, I'm going to see Dune.
Oh, I wish I could get out and get to see that one.
So hopefully I like it. I mean, everyone on Letterboxd has obviously been raving about it. And I think seeing it in the cinema will help, because apparently it's a very visually impressive, orally impressive film.
That's what I hear. And I've read the book too.
I'm going into it blind. I really know nothing about Dune at all. So
what I do know about it, you may want to wiki that a little bit, man. there's a lot of lore and you know, some of the older movies which didn't do so well, like the David Lynch one. You know, they get lambasted constantly, but from my understanding, they do a slightly better job of setting up the lore, because I think there's a bit of like opening dialogue where they kind of set the scene a little bit. But it is kind of dense. And I think they kind of just walk you right into it. And the new Dune is what I've been hearing, which I love that approach. But don't let that alienate you. I would look it up. You know, look up some of the stuff. Maybe there's got to be like a spoiler-free article which kind of sets it up for you, which you might want to do. I don't know one on top of my head, but I would check that out.
Yes, yeah. But yeah, I'm sort of the same as you. I haven't seen a lot of films released this year.
Well, from this experience, the one we're going to talk about today, maybe that's a good thing. Do you want to start with that one, for that matter?
Yes, okay. Yeah. So let's kick it off with your pick.
Heads up, the films we're about to discuss may contain spoilers. For a list of the movies we cover this week, check out the description.
So this was my pick this week. And, you know, the format is supposed to be that we pick like a movie that we love or that we hate and we go from there. But we keep picking movies that we love because we love talking about movies that we love. And today we're going to enjoy talking about a movie that we hated, or at least I hated. What was your take on this?
I gave it 2 stars. So it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, because I've seen everyone on Letterboxd just trashing it. But it wasn't a good film by any stretch. Yeah.
Okay, we're at least basically on the same page. So we saw Red Notice on Netflix from this year, of course, starring everyone who had nothing better to do: Dwayne Johnson, Ryan Reynolds, Gal Gadot, Ritu Arya. Directed by Rawson Marshall Thurber, who also directed, I'm not surprised, Dodgeball, Skyscraper, Meet the Miller, or Were the Millers, which that I remember that one kind of made me laugh a few times. It was okay. Yeah, what is your take on this garbage? Let's hear you try to defend your half star rating above mine.
Well, so it was funny. I think it was what day is it now? Monday for me, Sunday for you. I think it was last week I read an article, not knowing that, you know, we were going to watch this film, of course, but I read an article from the New York Times, who I love and adore, and it was talking about Netflix's movies, right? Because of a common criticism of Netflix and the films that Netflix makes itself are that they're not very good, right? And that sort of is the stigma around Netflix-made films is that they're more, you know, if they're hit and miss, they're more miss than hit, right?
I remember being quite the opposite, too, when Netflix first started coming out with their own content. I remember at the time, like when they first started doing it, I don't remember anything off the top of my head, like some examples, but I remember thinking that these were very good and very promising. And then, I don't know, I guess money happened.
So I'm going to quote from the article here, and then I'll attempt to give a bit of a reason as to why I think their sort of in-house films have been so bad. The article says, "The company has shifted its priorities from being the place where big-name filmmakers bring passion projects that the studios find too risky. Think Alfonso Cuarón's Roma or Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. Now the company is aiming straight for what the old-line studios do best. The PG-13 all-audience films that traditionally pack movie theaters, create a cultural moment, and often transform into lucrative franchises." And then it goes on to quote Scott Stuber, who is Netflix's global film chief. And he says, "I think one of the fair criticisms has been we make too much and not enough is great. I think what we want to do is refine and make a little less better and more great. If you have a budget to make 14 movies and you only have 11 great ones, let's just make 11. That is what we need to aim toward because you really are in a deeply competitive world now and you want to make sure that you're delivering at a pace that people see greatness consistently instead of randomly." Now, I think all of that is true. I think he's, you know, somewhat self-aware, which is good. But he, you know, I'm sure he realizes that the public perception of Netflix films are that they're not very good either critically or audience-wise. Because, you know, sometimes there's a disconnect there. You know, a good example, I watched a film on Netflix, funny enough, called John Q. Last night, I believe, starring Denzel Washington. I want to see it forever because I love Denzel. It wasn't very good. I gave it 1.5 stars. It was just an absolutely stupid fucking movie. The basic premise of it is, like, Denzel, his character, his son in the film, has to have, like, a heart transplant, but, like, they can't afford it. So then he, like, decides to, like, take the hospital hostage so that, like, his son can get, like, the heart transplant. Anyway, I'm sure you would have some comments on it from, like, a healthcare perspective and some of the things happening in the film. And
yeah, I haven't been in that situation from a healthcare perspective. That's a bit extreme. I don't know that a doctor... I haven't seen the movie. I don't know that a surgery team... I wouldn't want to stress out my son's heart transplant team.
Yeah, but like it's that film, for instance, like I think it's sitting at like 23% on Rotten Tomatoes, but like on cinema score, like the audience scale, like an A sort of thing, right? So I know sometimes there's a disconnect between what the critics think and what the audience think, but I think with like Netflix films, it's very much on the same page, and the critics are like, this is shit, and audiences are like, this is shit. And so I think there's a few reasons for that. So I was thinking about it last night, and I wrote down a few reasons. I think one is that Netflix, so I'll use an analogy here, right? So yesterday I went to see an art exhibition. It was an exhibition on Henri Matisse. If you don't know, he's a French painter around in the, you know, sort of late 1800s, early to mid 1900s. He was sort of painting, I don't know if he was painting in the 1880s. I definitely know he was painting in 1890, and he painted through up until, you know, the 50s. So I went to saw his an exhibition from him yesterday. It was very good. But Netflix making films is sort of like if I lived in France in like the 1940s and I was like, it's cool. So Henri Matisse has been painting for like 50 years or whatever. I'm going to paint now and I'm going to upend the art scene. At that point, nothing I produce would be as good as anything he could produce because he's been doing it far longer than I have. Bring it back to film, Netflix. Now, I know Netflix has been around for something like 20 years or even longer, perhaps. I don't know. But I know originally they started out as a DVD rental company. And then obviously that, you know, died off and then they transitioned into what they are now as a streaming service. And I don't know how long they've been making their own content. I would guess... it's probably, I'd say, within the last 10 years.
I think less than that.
Yeah, it could be even 5 years. Since they became a streaming service, pretty much. They're going up against studios. Like, some of these studios have been around for 100 years. Like, some of them have been around since the 1910s, 1920s, right? What these studios have is they have so much data on everything. They have so much data on audience tastes, on audience viewership habits, on when is the best time to release a film, what do audiences want to see, etc., etc. Netflix doesn't have that. Now, Netflix has data of their own, of course. I mean, they have, you know, so much data on people streaming, and that's how they get the algorithm and what they recommend you, etc., etc. They don't have that time that the studios have, where they haven't had decades and decades to refine their output, where they haven't had the experts at the table who are giving them insights. And this is not me excusing it at all, because the speed of which things move today, you know, theoretically they should have been able to catch up. But I think one of the reasons is they're going up against people who have been at this a hell of a lot longer than they have, who know a hell of a lot more about it than they do. And they're sort of amateurs going up against the pros, really.
Well, I'm going to give you a different take on this. Not that I'm disagreeing with you, but a different perspective, perhaps. I don't think they really care.
Yeah, fair point.
Because money. If you are a like someone who produces a product, and, you know, mass market, like furniture, like IKEA, for example. Okay, you go from old school, handmade, super experienced craftsman making a desk, and then you can buy something really cheap, not as well made, but good enough from IKEA. There's already this thing where you can outproduce the really, really nice stuff, and you can put it in more people's homes. The thing with Netflix is it's like that, except it's already in their homes. So many people are already subscribing to Netflix that if they produce crap, it's a numbers game. Just people are going to watch it. Not everyone's going to like it, but a ton of people are going to watch it. And no one's going to, you know, if you have a bad movie in the theater, they release a movie in the theater and it turns out to be bad. It, you know, word of mouth, fewer people may see that movie. Sure, you say, no, it's not worth buying a ticket to that movie. It doesn't matter with Netflix, because if they produce a movie that is not as good, no one's going to, how many people are really going to cancel their subscription, which is where they're making their money? They're not making their money off the movies themselves, like individual movies. They're making money off the subscriptions.
Yeah.
So it's something they can offer, and you know, it's appeals to the lowest common denominator, where you're going to get enough people liking it, enough people watching it. Netflix is one of those things too, where you put it on when you're doing something else. You know, that's usually when I watch Netflix. That's what I initially started watching Red Notice for. I was putting some stuff together in our guest bedroom, and I had it on the TV in the guest bedroom, and I had it on, and I finished what I was doing early and ended up watching most of the movie. And they don't differentiate that. They're getting your money either way. I don't think they really care. I think they're just throwing stuff at the wall, and whatever sticks is going to make a lot of money.
It's a good point. I think part of it too is a vicious cycle in the sense, right? Traditionally, Netflix, Hollywood has traditionally been very hostile to Netflix, right? And that's everyone from directors, studios, actors, etc. Like, people didn't really want to work with them. They wanted to go to the studios, anything else. You know, one of the things that this article I read was saying was that, sort of like that paragraph I quoted, they're now getting people proactively coming to them and saying, we actually want you to make our film, as opposed to saying, oh, no one, the studios won't touch our film, can you make it for us? So I'm hopeful that we'll sort of see the tide shift. Anyway, that's a very long way of saying that I think Red Notice was a typical Netflix film in the way everyone thinks of it. It was just poor.
It was soulless. It had no lightness eyes, you know? It was just like a paint by numbers. God, how do you even describe this fucking movie? And it wouldn't bother me. It's just that the budget was so much money. When I looked it up, it said $160 million. I've seen people quote $200 million for this movie. So I haven't looked at the numbers. Someone said that Dune cost less than this movie, which is, if that is true, it's just unbelievable. It tried to be a reference machine, first of all, referencing stuff constantly. Ryan Reynolds basically just was Deadpool. You may as well make this like a prequel to Deadpool. This is just the same fucking character. It's the same fucking jokes. This guy is, he makes me laugh. He's just very typecast. I don't know if he'll ever get a role that's not a Deadpool character. Gal Gadot just looked hot. I don't remember a single line of dialogue she said because they didn't put her in there for anything else. She didn't try because she didn't have to. I don't think they needed her to try to do anything. I don't remember her fucking character's name. I'm looking it up right now. It was Sarah Black / the Bishop. See, I had to look that up. I saw this movie very recently. Dwayne Johnson is Dwayne fucking Johnson. They put him in another jungle. They went out of their way to put him in another jungle. He was there for like 2 minutes. It was quicker travel than the season 8 of Game of Thrones. Just to get him in a jungle. He was there for like 10 minutes. I don't know. They tried to make this like expansive. I don't know. The inspector, what is it? I'm looking it up. Inspector Urvashi Das. Her and her team were like G.I. Joes. Like, does Interpol even act like this? I find it hard to believe that they just have jurisdiction absolutely everywhere with no red tape, apparently. And they're a goon squad. Like, it was like a G.I. Joe, Indiana Jones. It wanted to be all that stuff. Everything felt disjointed and thrown together. I don't know if maybe I should have looked it up more. Maybe it went through a ton of rewrites or something. But it was very unfunny, lifeless, not clever, trying too hard. Ryan Reynolds went out of his way to drink some aviation gin in his hideout. I don't know if you know that, but that's his company. It's not bad gin either. I actually have some downstairs.
I did say it now. It's like, oh, product placement. Cool.
Very, very blatant product placement. I mean, usually in like movies, if someone pours like a stiff drink, like a couple fingers of scotch or something, I mean, they're doing like a brown, you know, like a dark liquor, almost always, because it doesn't look like water. And audiences are stupid, so you can't just have them pour like vodka or gin in a glass. First of all, how many people drink gin straight? I don't really care about this movie. It was a stupid, safe movie it was very safe and consequence free. I could tell no one was going to die. I don't even think there was any blood in the movie.
No, very little.
What was this fucking movie even rated? G? I mean, no, I don't care about this movie.
Much of the same criticism that you have, I had. So I do have a few positives to say about it, but I'll trash it a bit first. So yeah, look, I thought the dialogue was just very cringy, you know, very cringy. It was trying so hard to be funny, and it just wasn't. And what we're going to touch on later in the episode, some of the best comedies from the noughties. And what some of the films that I'm going to mention later do, what they do so well, is they're not trying to be funny. Stuff's just happening and it's just hilarious. And what Red Notice is doing is they're trying so damn hard to be funny, but they're not.
I didn't think they're trying that hard. I think saying that they're trying gives them a lot of credit. I don't think they care. I think this was a paycheck movie. This was the equivalent of me going to work and not doing any fucking work. I can't imagine that anyone cared about this movie because it didn't feel like anyone cared about this movie.
A lot of it I found to be too, and I hate this in movies, it was just too expository. Like it was, I kind of give you an example, but they like explain everything to a minute detail. I'm like, we have eyes, like we can see, we don't need you to do that, you know.
Oh yeah, they really hold your hand through everything. But the thing is, this is going to appeal to stupid people. And that's what they wanted. Stupid people have money too. And if they feel like they're not being challenged in any way and that's what they like, I mean, Netflix has got your number, man.
You know, the action was just over the top. You know, the stunts were ridiculous.
Way ridiculous. I could turn my brain off for like dumb fun. My brain doesn't go this far off. You know what I mean? It's not in service of anything that I can enjoy. It's not clever. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon had ridiculous action, but it was beautiful. It was in service of that. It was like an artistic, like a beautiful thing. You know, it had that angle. And there are other films which are where it's ridiculous, but it's clever in its ridiculousness. This was nothing. It was just ridiculous just because that it was flashy. But again, they don't care. They made a shitload of money on this movie, I'm sure.
Yeah, and the story, like you said, was very paint-by-numbers, very predictable. I mean, there were so many Deus Ex Machinas there. And it was, I was just like, oh, look, they get saved again. Oh, they get saved again. I'm like, you know, like you said, no one was ever going to die. Like I said, no one even, people would get, you know, hurt or whatever. And they, you know, wouldn't have a scratch on them. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's totally realistic. Cool. And I'm saying all that, I think, you know, I like this film a bit more than you just said. I didn't think it was a good film by any stretch, but I do have a few positives I can give it.
Okay, hit me.
I didn't realize this until I read some of the reviews. Some of it was CGI, which some of it I got because some of it I could tell was CGI. Like when they were going around to different places in the world, etc., I thought that looked good. Like the places they filmed in were nice. But I don't know how much of that was like CGI or green screen. I don't know. I read some stuff that made me doubt they actually filmed on location at those places. Anyway, I thought the places they traveled to, whether they actually traveled there or whether it was like the trickery of film, I thought they looked good. So I'll give that some credit. It was a long runtime. I think it was like 2 hours 20 or something around there. But I do think it was fairly fast-paced. It was a long film, but it didn't drag, if that makes sense. Like, the action did keep moving forward. It wasn't like long stretches of just nothing happening. I will begrudgingly admit, I did laugh a few times throughout. It wasn't common.
Traitor.
But there were...
No, I'm kidding. I chuckled a couple times too, yeah, but I've already like, forgotten what it is.
I'm the same. Like, there were a few moments that did make me laugh, but generally speaking, I was sort of sat there with a stone face, like, this is not funny whatsoever. I will say, I didn't see the twist coming. Basic premise, like, we haven't talked about the premise yet, because we've been trashing it. The basic premise is that there were these three eggs that Mark Antony apparently gave to Cleopatra back in the day. Some Egyptian billionaire wants the eggs to give to his daughter at her upcoming wedding. Ryan Reynolds' character, an art thief, goes to steal the eggs. Dwayne Johnson's character is an FBI agent who's stopping him, and Gal Gadot's character is another art thief who was also after the eggs. As the movie goes on, Ryan Reynolds and Dwayne Johnson team up to try and stop Gal Gadot's character from getting the eggs. Anyway, we get to the end, and the twist is that Dwayne Johnson's character was not this FBI agent. He was actually in cahoots with Gal Gadot, and they were both big-time art thieves. So I actually thought, because I knew something like that was going to happen, like I could see where it was going. I'm like, oh yeah, someone's going to be revealed or something else. I actually thought it was going to be that Ryan Reynolds and Dwayne Johnson's character were working together. So the fact that it was Dwayne Johnson and Gal Gadot, I didn't see that coming, but I saw, like, I knew that Dwayne Johnson's character probably wasn't who he said he was. They just switched it, so I didn't... I got the person wrong, but I got the premise right, if that makes sense.
When the twist happened, I was just like, I don't care about this at all.
So yeah, so there's not a whole lot of positive we can say about this film.
Yeah, I don't know. I've kind of already forgotten most of it, which is a really bad sign. I watched it pretty recently.
I mean, it's sitting at 2.5 average on Letterboxd, so it's not said. It's not a good film.
It's just a film that doesn't matter. They had what's his name? That singer.
Oh yeah, Ed Sheeran made a random cameo appearance.
Ed Sheeran. Yeah, it was I got a chuckle when the three eggs were there. They finally got their MacGuffins and they sold them and. And she's like, oh, wow. And then Ed Sheeran shows up. She's like, oh, my God, Ed Sheeran. I got kind of a chuckle out of that. But then Ed Sheeran, like, stayed in the movie for a minute. And that annoyed me. Because I don't care. I don't listen to music really at all. Even if I did, I mean, it's not my thing. Because honestly, his music, what I've heard of it, is just as, like, made by algorithms as these movies we're complaining about. If you've heard one of his songs, you've heard all of his songs. And that my wife has heard more of his stuff. And that was always her complaint, too. It's just, it's the same car with a different paint job, really. The thing is, I keep seeing him in fucking movies, but he's not like an actor. He keeps just not staying in his lane. I don't care about his music, really. I think it's weird, like, first of all, when grown men get upset about music that's clearly meant for, like, you know, teenage girls. So that's not my problem. My problem is just, why does he keep coming into these movies? Do they just, is that like a thing? He was in Yesterday, too. Yeah, and it just made me like him even less because I'm like, oh, I hope he's not like this in real life. But he probably is. But I just didn't need to think about that. And it just made me upset.
You took words out of my mouth. I was going to say the exact same thing. Like, he needs to stay in his lane. He's become very successful at being a singer, whether he's good or not is a matter of opinion. But he's become very successful at it. So he just needs to sort of you know, stick to that. Don't venture into to films or TV because he can't do it. So
my wife refers to him as one of the best business people in music, because he just he knows how to make a buck off of the same shit over and over and over. Do you need to be in all these fucking movies now? Not doing anything but just being a cameo? I thought this would be like a funny rip on the movie, but I kind of just, as I talk about it, it just depresses me. What a forgettable experience. Not recommended.
Okay, well, let's transition to an actual funny comedy film, which is my pick. So this is Hot Fuzz, 2007 film out of the UK, directed by Edgar Wright. It's the second film in his Cornetto trilogy. The first one is Shaun of the Dead, which was 2004, and then The World's End.
Yeah, why is it called that, by the way?
The Cornetto trilogy.
Yeah, why is it called the Cornetto trilogy? I never really... Am I missing something?
I don't know if you have them in America. I don't know if we even have them over here in Australia. We might. I mean, I know of them because I lived in England, so I know what they are, but I don't know if we have them here. Anyway, it's an ice cream brand.
Is this something I'm just too American to understand?
I think the only reason it's called that is because they show a Cornetto ice cream in each of those three films. That's about it. So yeah, so it's Shaun of the Dead 2004, Hot Fuzz 2007, The World's End 2013. I mean, they're not a trilogy in the sense that they don't follow on to each other at all. They just happen to star the same people and are directed by the same person. So I know we've referenced Hot Fuzz a few times on different episodes before, but this is our first time talking about it. I think this is the second time I've seen it this year. I've owned it forever. It's just an incredibly funny film. I don't actually have a comedy list, like a comedy genre list. I suspect it would probably make it into my top 10 comedies.
You seem to revere it. Every time you talk about it, there's this reverence in your voice. You really like it.
It's just so funny. And like, I rewatched it, I guess, a couple of weeks ago. And I didn't expect to like it again as much as I did. I mean, I've seen it so many times, but I sort of find when you see something, you know, so often, it can, not always, but it can sort of lose its impact on you. But I was just laughing the whole way through this. And this is, I don't know how many times I've seen it before. So the plot, for those who haven't seen it, is there's a police officer played by Simon Pegg called Nicholas Angel, who works in London. He's just a very high-flying police officer and he's very good. But basically, he's so good, he is making everyone else look bad. So they transfer him to this very small town called Sanford. At the surface level, it's about him adjusting to life as sergeant of this small town. But in the background, there's all these shadowy goings on because there's this group called the Neighborhood Watch Alliance, I think they're called, secretly run the town and kill off anybody they don't like, and all in order to keep their Village of the Year crown that they've won for the last like 20 years or something. I probably didn't do a very good job describing that, but it's sort of a film you need to watch to sort of experience what it's about. I guess to compare it to Red Notice in a sense, Hot Fuzz is like effortlessly funny. Like they didn't have to try because the script is so good and it's so well written. You're just laughing the whole way through. I think one of the best things Hot Fuzz does, you sort of don't realize this until you get sort of midway through the film, latter part of a film, and then you're like, oh, and you connect the dots, is it uses foreshadowing so well. Because there's so much stuff they mention in the early parts of a film, which at the time you're like, you don't pay any attention to it because you're like, oh, what's whatever, some weird reference or something or some throwaway comment. And then it connects down the line.
Yeah, pretty much everything they say in the first act has some kind of payoff later.
Exactly.
Later in the movie.
Yeah.
Which is really masterful the way they did that. And you can spot them. You can almost check them off your list. You know, it is very rewarding. And it has this like British just brevity to its comedy style where it's very quick witted.
Yes.
And it's subtle when it needs to be, but you, I don't know. The editing really helped too. It's very snappy sort of editing where it really paid off too, was where it's doing this snappy editing for small little mundane moments, this over the top action editing style shot for like efficiency and different multiple camera angles and moving very quickly and very short little cuts while they're doing mundane everyday chores and things like that. it just works on every level. They thought everything through, and it feels so effortless because it is so polished.
Yeah, it's a very purposeful film.
It really, really is. And it makes fun of this specific like buddy cop action genre, action comedy genre, so well. I'm trying to think of like a really good example. I mean, well, the best example is the one guy's character who's constantly asking, like, have you seen this movie? Have you seen that movie? Have you ever done this? Have you ever done that? And then having that payoff later in a way where even the characters seem self-aware that they're getting to do all this shit that they never thought they would get to do.
As far-fetched as the plot is, in that it's about this, you know, group of aging residents of a small town who are part of this decade-long conspiracy to, you know, kill off all the undesirables, but it's also, like, yes, that is the plot of a film, but it's also a comment on, like, just other more banal things, right? It's a comment on, like, the difference between big city life and life in this small, sleepy village. It's a thing about, you know, work and our passion. Because, you know, Nicholas Angel, policing is very much his passion. It's not just a job for him. Like, it's not even a career, it's a passion. Like, he lives for it. It consumes him. You know, he mentions numerous times throughout the film, like, I can't switch off. Like, he lives to police, right? And so it's sort of a, I don't know if elegy is the right word, perhaps it is, but it's sort of an elegy, I guess, towards, like, life, and that, like, it's not, like, because you go through this journey for the film, you know, he comes into Sanford originally, he's just very, like, I don't know what the word is, like, very focused on work, I don't want to talk about anything else about work, that's it, and he sort of goes through the film, and he forms friendships, and he gains people's trust, and he becomes this integral part of a community, but he got there because he wasn't so focused on work, right? He started to let people into his life. He started to form friendships. He started to connect with Nick, who's his partner. So, you know, so I think it's a comment on that. But again, it is this very funny, hilarious film about this murderous NWA. Yeah, so I just think, yeah, like you said, the writing, the editing, the acting, I think, you know, I do own Shaun of the Dead. I haven't seen it in a very long time, so I can't remember what happens. But in my head, I have it as like a 4.5-star film. So it's also very funny. But I haven't seen Simon Pegg and... Oh, sorry, his partner's name is Danny. The actual actor's name is Nick. Yes, I haven't seen Simon Pegg and Nick Frost in a lot of other stuff. So I can't comment as to, I guess, how funny they are in other films. But certainly in this film, their chemistry together is just incredible. And they just bounce so well off each other where you don't even, like, it sort of transcends film in a sense. Like, you don't even feel like you're watching a film. You're like, you feel like you're watching the exploits of these two cops in this small village.
I just love the way that they take this card cut, like, format of these types of buddy cop movies. And then they exploit every single part of that format. And they really deconstruct it so well. Even, like, when he thinks he's being betrayed by Nick Frost's character, when he, you know, he stabs him and then he takes him out of the middle of nowhere. He's like, you got to leave. He's like, come with me. We'll bring the whole, you know, the full weight of the London Metropolitan Police on the, and it even that is just, that's part of the formula. There's a movie like that. There are a moment like not in all these movies, and they do so well to just pull it apart piece by piece. I mean, really take every single piece down and then they put it back together with their own flair. And the way that everything is translated to the screen is just so crisp and just clean. And there's nothing feels like rough around the edges. Everything is just very polished. It's very funny. It's very clever. It's very witty. It's sort of, it moves quick.
Playing off that classic comedy duo of like the straight man of a comic. You know, Nicholas Angel is very much a straight man of a serious person, and Danny is, you know, the sort of silly joker, you know, never really serious. But that works so well, and then, as I mentioned earlier, it sort of gets to the point where, Nicholas can sort of, he can sort of be a bit more funny now. You know, we get to the end of the film, and he's, you know, he's not as uptight as he was.
Yeah, he opens up a little bit.
Yeah, you know, there's growth there. Also, just shout out to the music. I thought the music... You know, the music they picked, the songs they picked, were just fitted so well They throw in Village Green Preservation Society by the Kinks, which just works so well because that whole thing is about like the Village Green in this small English town, and they played it like this perfect time, and that, all the songs they pick throughout are just very well placed. But yeah, it's really, honestly, I can't fault this film in any way whatsoever. To me, it's a 5-star film. It's just incredible. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, there's basically nothing wrong with it. Yeah, even the way that they, you know, he gets to the big motive reveal where he's talking to the villains, and he had this big elaborate conspiracy all figured out, where in a buddy cop movie that takes itself more seriously, that's the motive, you know, that he nailed it. He figured it out, and they're just saying, oh, yep, that's it. But you'll never tell anyone because we're going to kill it, you know, and they have this big monologue moment. And then part of the comedy is that all of that was just coincidence. They don't like inconvenient or ugly things. And that's what it was. Oh, we didn't like his house. It had nothing to do with the land. I didn't even realize it was worth that much. No, we just didn't like his house, you know? And you see like everything just kind of, he delivers these lines of like, it was because of this that you did this. And you thought you were going to get away with blah, blah, blah. And then it just falls flat. He's just perplexed that like, that's all it was. Like, it was this simple the whole time. It wasn't all this complicated stuff. It was really all just coincidence. You guys just, these petty things, you're killing people for that. And that's part of the comic, is it's just taking the air out of the balloon like that.
There's no villagers out there in England or any other country that are going out there, you know, murdering their populace to ensure that they, you know, win village titles. But I think the comment that it's making on sort of, not so much small town because it's more village, but like, you know, village life, say in the UK, or really any place, is that a lot of places are like that, right? They are very insular. They are very prideful. They do treat outsiders with a sense of suspicion. You know, you hear in a lot of small towns where everyone knows everyone sort of thing. It is very gossip-driven, right? It is very disapproving of certain things that in a big city no one would care about, right? In a big city, if there's someone who's a living statue, you know, like you know, or who's someone who's a juggler, or someone who builds a big house. The couple who I think they got killed first, who were bad actors, right? They were doing like Amdram, and they were doing like Romeo and Juliet, and the acting was so bad that they were like, oh, we'll kill them because they're bad actors. Like, in real life, villages, and I've never lived in a place like that, so I can't comment, but I imagine like real villages, there would be a lot of gossip around like, oh, God, isn't Martin Draper and Eve Blower, aren't they just awful actors? Oh, isn't George Merchant's house just so ugly and bawdry and not in fitting with the theme of the village? Oh, isn't that living statue the most, you know, and like, but obviously the film sort of takes it to the extreme, and they're like, oh, well, we don't just dislike these people, we're going to kill them. I wouldn't want anyone to watch a film and think it's just some silly, you know, far-fetched action parody, because I think it's so much more than that. And I think it succeeds because it is so much, it is more intelligent than what its premise suggests. And it is, like you said, so witty as a result.
I haven't officially rated or reviewed it yet. I'm a little behind. I don't know, at least 4 stars, maybe more.
Great. Well, let's move on to our topic for the episode. So swiftly following on from that. So we'll be talking about the best comedy films of the 2000s. Hot Fuzz was 2007. So I've got a bit of a list. So I might run through my list first, and we'll see if there's any overlap with some of the films you picked out. So mine is ranked. So I've got 10 films. I'll run through them quickly because we don't have all day. So, best comedy films of the 2000s. Number one, to me, Hot Fuzz, at the top, 5 stars. Easy. Number two, another British film. A lot of people don't know about this film, I feel like. I'd never heard of it before I watched it earlier this year, but it's very funny. I was just laughing the whole way through. It's called In the Loop. Have you heard of it?
No, I've not heard of this one.
Yeah, a lot of people haven't. It has some fairly big names. It has Peter Capaldi in, James Gandolfini is there, and sort of a he's sort of advertised as like a big star in it, but he's sort of more of a minor character. Tom Hollander, Gina McKee. Anyway, it's sort of about politicians and people, and it's talking about like the invasion of Iraq and how sort of a politician to dealing with it. It's sort of like Hot Fuzz, but it's sort of a film you need to experience and watch. It is just so funny. I gave it 5 stars. It is just
it's got a 3.8 average on Letterboxd. I read the synopsis. It looks pretty darn funny, actually.
It's probably one of the funniest films I've seen this year. It is, as I said, not a lot of people know about it, but it's sort of a hidden gem. Number three is, I haven't seen it in a few years. I loved it when I was growing up. I think I could like quote every line of this film when I was like 12, which is Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I said I haven't seen it in a few years. I'm sure I would still find it funny now. I feel like it is one of those films where the older you get, the less funnier it gets, because I think it is probably more funny when you are a teenager as opposed to when you're sort of in your, you know, late 20s, early 30s. But it is still you know, a very funny film. The next one I think I've mentioned once before is sort of my ultimate guilty pleasure film, which is The Devil Wears Prada.
I've never actually seen that.
It's very funny. I mean, some of it is laugh out loud funny, some of it is just like ridiculous funny. Like, you're just watching it like, I can't believe these people act like this. But that is, yeah, it's a very funny film. It's a film I can constantly rewatch, and I just enjoy every time I watch it. Number five is Little Miss Sunshine, which I saw earlier this year. A bit of a dark comedy. It's not so much a classic comedy in a sense. It's a bit more bleak.
I remember it had some sad elements. Yeah,
it is still a funny film at times. Number six is, as I alluded to earlier, another Edgar Wright film, Shaun of the Dead. Again, I haven't seen it in, I would estimate, 10 years, if not longer. But as I said, in my head, I have it at like 4.5 stars. I have it as a very funny film. Whether it still holds up, because I haven't seen it in so long, I don't know. But in my head, it's incredibly funny. Number seven is a sequel, actually. So it's called Analyze That. It's the sequel to Analyze This. Both films star Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal. I think they're incredibly funny. I have them both at 4.5 stars. I do think Analyze This is a little bit funnier than Analyze That, but they're both so funny. I think Robert De Niro never gets enough credit. You know, a lot of people talk about Robert De Niro and talk about all his dramatic performances, but I think he never gets enough credit for how funny he is. Like, some of my favorite Robert De Niro films are comedies. He just excels so much in this, as is Billy Crystal. Billy Crystal is very funny as well. But yeah, Analyze That, 2002 sequel to the 1999 film Analyze This. Again, I feel like not a lot of people know about those films, but they're just so, so funny to me. Number eight, Pineapple Express. Stupid film, but hilarious. Again, a stoner. I'm not a, you know, it's like a stoner comedy, which I'm not really into at all. But Pineapple Express just does it for me. It's just, it sort of goes into the thing. It's like, it's so dumb. It's just funny. Number nine is another British film, Love Actually. Again, a bit of a more of a, you know, drama slash comedy. Good Christmas film. You know, Christmas is only a few weeks away, so if anyone wants a good Christmas film, I'd recommend Love Actually. But yes, it has its funny moments. Again, it's sort of a mix of comedy and drama, but it has its moments. And the 10th film, final one, before I pass the baton over to you, is I haven't seen this film in a long time, but I feel like it has to be referenced just for the impact it's had on popular culture, is Mean Girls. I think it was last week at work, and like there were a few team members wearing pink, and someone was like, oh, on Mondays we wear pink. Like, it's over, what, 15 years since, I think it was 2004 it came out. People were still quoting it. You know, that's staying power right there. And it is a very funny film. Again, maybe it's something like Napoleon Dynamite, where it's funnier when you're in high school and you can relate to it.
It is, but I think both of those examples do still hold up. Yeah.
So that's my list.
Yeah, I didn't compile a list. I didn't bother, and here's why. I'm not a comedy guy. I'm not really big into comedy movies. They, as a general rule, my take on them is that they typically do not age well. We listed a couple things that we both consider to be exceptions, but I do not think that 99% of comedy films age well. And not only like do they not age well, but I mean, when you go back and watch them, like, they're cringe inducing. And plus, it's too easy to fall into just lazy, just potty humor, shit writing, like, just awful. I don't know. It really is, for me, like, the lowest, appeals to the genre that is meant more than any other to appeal to the lowest common denominator. That being said, there are some that I haven't seen most of these recently, but I remember them being funny. Kind of a bro movie that I remember enjoying when it first came out was Old School. from 2003. I have not seen that in years. I don't know if I would say it holds up, but I remember that one being funny. It's hard to pick movies that I liked. I mean, there's just so much shit. Like, first of all, anything with Adam Sandler, I'm not a fan of.
Oh God, I hate him so much.
Yeah, I hate Adam Sandler. I mean, not him as a person. I'm sure he's fine, but I can't stand watching him in movies.
Good.
That being said, there was one movie that he was not in it, but it was like an Adam Sandler film without Adam Sandler. It is actually probably my biggest guilty pleasure film. I'm ashamed of it. I'm ashamed of liking this movie. I really am. But I love this movie. It's Grandma's Boy from 2006, I think. I don't know. I hate everything about that movie, but I love that fucking movie. I laugh at it even though it's not funny. I should not like that movie, and I don't know why I do. I don't. But that might be my favorite comedy for completely, I mean, reasons that are completely inexplicable even to myself. Idiocracy, I remember, was actually fairly clever and perhaps a little prophetic.
I see a lot of people referencing that online. I've never seen it, but I see so many people all the time being like, oh, we're basically living in Idiocracy. Idiocracy got this right. Idiocracy was correct. So I want to check it out purely for that reason, because everyone just keeps referencing it all the time.
Yeah, I think the tragedy is that movie does age well, unfortunately. Of course, you know, Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead are classics. I actually have not seen the third one, World's End. I've not seen that one.
I've not seen it either.
I hear that it's the weakest addition to the franchise. I will get around to it eventually. But, you know, Hot Fuzz is, of course, going to be, and Shaun of the Dead are both towards the top of the list. Euro Trip is another kind of like bro film that I enjoyed when it first came out. I have not revisited that one. I have revisited a couple like bro movies that did not pan out for me, that where I'm just like, no, it didn't age well. I feel like Euro Trip and like Road Trip 2 they'd probably be the same way, where I don't think I'd like them if I watch them again. I don't know. Honestly, I wasn't really strong on this category because it's not a category I keep coming back to. I don't ever really go out of my way for comedies because they usually don't make me laugh. And usually if they do, then like 10 years later, I'm not laughing anymore. I'm sorry to disappoint, but you disappointed with the South Korean films. So we're even now.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't care about comedies.
I'm not a big comedy person overall. You know, give me a drama any day. There's some comedies that do it for me, but generally speaking, I'm sort of like you. A lot of them don't connect, and a lot of them just are not funny at all.
Yeah, you know what movie I remember being pretty funny when it came out, and then I rewatched it recently when I was remodeling my basement. I had it on Netflix, and it actually is so, not just like worse than I remember. It's cringe-inducingly bad. It was, I almost had to turn it off because I was like, oh, fuck, is The Girl Next Door. That's a horrendously unfunny, cringy movie. I hated it. And I remember it being pretty funny. So I feel like a lot of the films that I remember liking, that if I rewatch them, I would hate them.
I think that wraps up episode 12. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. As always, if you enjoyed today's podcast, we'd love it if you can give us a positive rating on Apple Podcasts. George will be back next week. Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you very much. See you on the other side.
Bye.